We're beginning a new series today on a much neglected book of the Bible, the book of Esther. There are reasons why it has been neglected, but no excuses. Many preachers and commentators have never touched this book. In fact, in 40 years of preaching and teaching myself, this is the first time that I have dealt with it in any thorough manner at all. I think back in the 70s, I went through this book in a couple of weeks on a Sunday night, but it wasn't anything I would call preaching today. But over the past few months, I have been studying this book with diligence and have actually become quite excited about it. And I believe it's going to be an excellent time for our church family to study over these next 6 or 7 weeks. I must warn you that I'm going to share some views that may challenge what you learned in Sunday school many years ago or what you currently believe about the book of Esther. I don't think that its two main characters, Mordecai and Esther, are what we would call great heroes of the faith or shining examples of godliness. They're heroes in the book, but they are not particularly heroes of the faith. Esther is no Daniel. I don't even think she's a Ruth. And Mordecai is no Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego. Both of these individuals, Esther and Mordecai, I see as secret believers, compromised believers, who barely maintain their cultural Jewish faith, to say nothing of being committed followers of God. They show courage, but not particularly courage for God. And yet God uses them anyway to accomplish His purposes. And to me, that's one of the great themes of the book of Esther, is that God will use people who have failed in many respects when in a crisis they will turn to Him. I want us to begin with some introduction and background. 2 weeks ago, we completed a month-long journey through the book of Ruth. As we noted, Ruth is the story of a Gentile girl who was taken in by the Jews and married a Jew. Esther, on the other hand, is the story of a Jewish girl taken in by the Gentiles and married a Gentile. But neither of these stories is really about their respective heroines. Both are ultimately stories about the larger story of God and His covenant to protect and redeem His people, even when they are disobedient to Him. Specifically, the purpose of Esther is to show how God took hundreds of thousands of Jews who were exiled in Persia and save them from extermination by His own hand. And its other purpose is to motivate these people to remember God's providence perpetually through a feast called Purim that some Jews still observe today. If Ruth is a story in which the providence of God is hidden behind the ordinary events of life, how much more is that true of the book of Esther? God's name is not mentioned even once in the 10 chapters of this book. That's why I came up with the title for this series, God Incognito, as seen in the book of Esther. There's a play on words intended there. He is incognito in one sense, and yet He is clearly seen in another sense. His providence, His grace, and His mercy run throughout this book. His fingerprints are everywhere. Both Ruth and Esther point us to Christ as the one whom God's grace and mercy ultimately comes to us as aliens and exiles, allowing us to become members of His family. A family which He will go to any lengths to protect. I might just add that I so appreciated Josh's message on adoption last Sunday. I thought it was a powerful message. And isn't it interesting that these two biblical women, Ruth and Esther, are both adopted. Ruth was really adopted by her mother-in-law, and Esther was officially adopted by her uncle Mordecai when her parents died in her youth. A word about authorship and date. The author of the book of Esther is unknown, although many scholars think that perhaps Ezra or Nehemiah wrote this book. The time of the writing is also unknown, although the time of the events in the book are known. The events in this book all take place between 483 and 473 B.C. And the book fits between the 6th and 7th chapters of Ezra. Xerxes is the king in our book. In some of your versions, he's called Ahasuerus, but it is clearly Xerxes the Great, who was the king of Persia during this entire period, 483 to 473 B.C. He had an extensive empire with 127 different provinces. The location is present-day Iran. I want to share some unusual facts about the book of Esther and then make a comment about the implication of these facts. First of all, Esther is one of only two biblical books named after a woman. Secondly, there is no mention of God in the book of Esther, as I've already said, but also no mention of the law of Moses or sacrifices or prayer or worship or the temple or even of the city of Jerusalem. Thirdly, the New Testament does not quote or allude to the book of Esther. It is only one of five books that are not mentioned in those fashions in the New Testament. Fourth, Esther is the only Old Testament book not found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Fifthly, for the first 7 centuries of the Christian church, not one commentary has survived on the book of Esther. We don't know whether any of them were written, but none has survived. Neither Luther nor Calvin, the great reformers of the 16th century, wrote anything on the book of Esther. And it's the only biblical book that they did not write on. In fact, Luther actually denounced this book. He said, "I am so great an enemy to the second book of Maccabees," that's an apocryphal book, "and to Esther, that I wish they had not come to us at all, for they have too many heathen unnaturalities." And sixthly, with the exception of Xerxes, no other person in the book has been historically verified. Now, my reason for mentioning these unusual facts is not to cause you to doubt whether the book of Esther belongs in the Bible, or doubt whether we should be paying any attention to it this morning. But rather, I want to just be honest with the facts, and I also want to explain why this book has, by and large, been neglected by the church. But some very valuable things are neglected, and I believe Esther is one of these. I'm convinced that Martin Luther must have had a bad case of indigestion the day he wrote what he did about the book of Esther. We won't even meet the two principal characters in the book of Esther this morning, that is Mordecai and Esther, because they don't come up in the first chapter. But we're going to lay the groundwork for their introduction, which will be next week. The title of my sermon this morning is original. I might as well admit it, because I don't think anybody else would claim it. I hope its meaning becomes clear as we read the first chapter together. So I invite you to turn in your Bible to the book of Esther. I believe it's on page 485 of most of the Pew Bibles, although we have several versions out there. But you should be able to find it that way, 485 in the Pew Bible, the book of Esther. We're going to read the entire first chapter. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush, that is the Upper Nile region. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes, and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zether, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king: Karshana, Sethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the 7 nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. So the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. Now, the book of Esther was not intended as a comedy, but a tragedy. However, the author has a lot of humor under the surface, in my estimation. I actually think he wants us to do a lot of laughing, particularly in this first chapter, as he delivers a very subtle satire of the most powerful monarch on the face of the earth. Xerxes the Great became king of Persia when his father Darius died in 486 BC. Our story begins in the third year of his reign, in 483 BC. At the very time that history tells us, this man, Xerxes, has decided to launch a major campaign against the Greeks to avenge his father's defeat in the great Battle of Marathon. Some scholars believe that this six-month-long exhibition of Xerxes' wealth was primarily for the purpose of convincing his nobles and the important people in his realm that he had enough money to pay them off if they would support him in this campaign against the Greeks. Nobles and officials from all over the then-known world are invited to his palace so the king can show off. Now, if you think the kind of spectacle described here in verses 5 to 8 is fanciful and totally unrealistic, perhaps you have a short memory. For just in 1971, the Shah of Iran, who deemed himself to have derived from the Persian monarchs, threw a party for the 2500th anniversary of the Persian Empire. And I want to read a description of a very short one of this amazing party that the Shah of Iran threw. It said a city of gold was planned by a Swiss interior design firm on 160 acres. 50 prefabricated luxury apartments with traditional Persian tent cloth surrounds were arranged in a star pattern around a central fountain, and vast numbers of trees were planted around them in the desert, creating something of how the ancient Persepolis, another capital of Persia, would have looked. The large tent of honor was designed for the reception of the dignitaries. The banqueting hall was the largest structure and measured nearly the size of a football field. The tent site was surrounded by gardens of trees and other plants flown in from France. Catering service was provided by Maxim's de Paris, which closed its restaurant in Paris for almost 2 weeks in order to provide for the glittering celebrations. Legendary hotelier Max Bleuet came out of retirement to supervise the banquet. Lavon designed the uniforms of the imperial household. 250 red Mercedes-Benz limousines were used to chauffeur guests from airport and back. Dinnerware was created by Limoges and linen by some other French guy I can't pronounce. Persians certainly know how to party. Ancient Persians as well as modern ones. But the focus of our chapter is not so much on this six-month-long party as upon the banquet that occurred at the end on the last 7 days, where Xerxes puts on the mother of all banquets. Xerxes' banquet is held in the enclosed garden of the king's palace, for you will remember the queen was having a banquet for the women inside the palace. Everyone in the winter capital of Susa is invited to this banquet. The decorations are described for us in some detail, talking about blue and white linens hanging, tied with silver rings to marble pillars, and the mosaic floors are made out of precious stones. Wine is served, it says, in golden goblets, and he made sure that no two goblets were alike. And he made a royal decree that no one be denied as much as he wanted to drink. Imagine how much wine was consumed. And this becomes an important issue in the story as we turn to the fact that on the last day of the banquet, Xerxes, while drunk, determines to show off his trophy wife. Remember that the queen is having her own banquet, and when Xerxes is high in spirits, which is a polite way of saying he's drunk, he sends seven of his eunuchs that are in charge of his harem to go get Vashti so he can display her beauty to the men. Now, something about this doesn't pass the smell test. If the king is drunk, I suppose most of the other men are drunk as well. The king is clearly treating Vashti as a sex object, as a toy to be played with. In fact, some Jewish commentators see behind the command in verse 11 that she appear wearing her royal crown the hint that that was all she was to wear. At any rate, Queen Vashti courageously refuses the king's request. And I think we need to understand that Vashti would not have done this lightly. She knew her husband well. She knew that he had a history of unpredictable, unreasonable, and despotic behavior. In fact, the Greek historian Herodotus tells us that when he carried on this campaign against the Greeks just a few years later, his engineers and construction crew couldn't get a bridge across the Hellespont built quickly enough because of a storm, so he had them all beheaded. She knows she is likely to pay a price for her refusal to come before the king. And sure enough, the king becomes furious and consults the wisest men of the kingdom concerning an appropriate course of action. He calls a special cabinet meeting. These seven men are the highest and wisest in the kingdom, which being translated means people who will tell the king what he wants to hear. These seven nobles are described as experts in law and justice, as wise men who understood the times, and as closest to the king. But in truth, they come across more like seven stooges, pompous characters gathering in a huddle, each giving an idea as to what should be done with Queen Vashti. Again, I believe the author wants us to laugh at these people. Theirs is a risky job, of course, because they have to come up with a plan for Queen Vashti that the king will still accept when he sobers up. And if, for example, they suggest that she be executed and then he begins to have second thoughts about what he's ordered done to her, they might follow her to the gallows. And those fears were not entirely unfounded. In fact, if you'll just turn ahead for a moment to the second chapter, verse 1, we read this. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. I think the underlying meaning here is he is having second thoughts about Vashti. And these seven men who so far have only said she needs to go and someone else needs to take her place have to scramble to come up with a plan that will get Xerxes' mind off of Vashti. And they will do that. They're ingenious, but that's getting ahead of our story. Then we see that all the wise men agree that Vashti's offense is not just personal to Xerxes. It's a universal offense. And they urge the king to issue an irrevocable decree that she be deposed and replaced. Here's how Memucan speaks for the other wise men in verse 16. Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. He then espouses the age-old domino theory. The domino theory has been employed many times in political crises. Some of you remember that President Johnson employed the domino theory at the height of the Vietnam War in the middle to late 60s. It kind of went like this. If we let Vietnam fall, the communists will take all of Southeast Asia and pretty soon they'll be landing in San Diego. Well, it didn't happen, did it? South Vietnam fell and the communist world went into pretty much of a stark decline 20 years later. But sometimes the theory, the domino theory, is a little more valid. It was also used in 1964 by opponents of the state lottery in New Jersey. New Jersey was the first modern state to adopt a lottery. And the opponents said, if we let New Jersey have an official lottery, gambling is going to take over this country. And it pretty much has, hasn't it? How many states now have lotteries? Over 40. 28 of them have casino gambling. So sometimes the theory, the domino theory, has more validity than other times. It has a somewhat checkered history. But Memucan's use of it is one of the most questionable for sure. He argues that if this offense against the king is overlooked, all women in the empire will despise their husbands. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. So the advisors urge him to make a law that cannot be revoked, that Vashti be deposed and a better queen put in her place. Better, of course, means more submissive. Although I doubt if she could be any less good-looking than Vashti. And so a royal decree is published throughout the empire that every man should be ruler of his own household. Once again, the humor is barely under the surface. In fact, can't you see that these clowns have really created the problem themselves? Because they have ordered that the Pony Express in Persia send this message that Vashti has defied her husband to every far corner of the empire. If women are going to rebel against their husbands only because these people have publicized that the king can't take care of his own house. Furthermore, if one woman's refusal of an unreasonable request by her drunk husband is all that stands in the way of a Persian version of women's lib, then these men in this empire have a very tenuous hold on their family's leadership. I cannot improve upon one author's questions at this point. He asks, what was actually achieved by all this huffing and puffing? Was the social order of Persia really threatened by this one woman's resistance? Even if it were true, if it were, can such a principle of male authority in the household really be imposed by governmental decree? Are all men to exercise power in such a self-centered way as Ahasuerus did and then expect instant obedience? Is every man supposed to banish his wife if she fails to submit to his will? Those are the kinds of questions that come to my mind, certainly, as I read this story. Now, that's essentially the story as we have it in verse 1. I hope it whets your appetite for what is to come, but my purpose in this series is not just to tell the story of Esther. It's to get behind that story and talk to you about truth issues that impact our lives. And I'd like to do that by posing this question. How can we survive as exiles under the empire? We haven't yet met the principal characters of the book of Esther. Esther and Mordecai, but I'll tell you just a little bit about them. They are both Jewish, And the recipients of this story, the ones to whom it was written, were Jewish. The writer of the story is Jewish. But none of these Jews live in Jerusalem or even in the Holy Land. They live in Persia. They are exiles. I want to go back in history a little bit and tell you how they got there and why they stayed there, because I think it's very relevant to our own stories. In about 1100 BC, which would be 650 years before our story takes place, the kingdom of Israel was established. It had three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon, and then the kingdom split apart right after the death of Solomon in 931 BC. 10 tribes formed the kingdom of Israel. 2 tribes formed the kingdom of Judah. The northern kingdom quickly went apostate. And of their 19 kings in their history of about 200 years, not a single one was a godly king. God warned them many times. They refused to repent, and so he allowed the Assyrians to come and wipe them off the map. They are today called the 10 lost tribes of Israel because no Jew alive today can trace his heritage back to any of those 10 tribes. The southern kingdom was almost as bad, but they at least had 8 kings out of their 20 kings who were somewhat godly. God tolerated the southern kingdom of Judah for another century and a quarter, but when they persisted in rebellion against him, he allowed the king of the brand new empire called Babylon to come against them. The king's name was Nebuchadnezzar, and he came against Israel in 606 BC. He took a lot of plunder from the capital city, and he also took some captives. Among those captives was Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He came back 8 years later and took thousands more captives as slaves back to Babylon. And then he returned one more time in 586 BC and wiped Jerusalem off the map. Not one stone was left standing upon another. Judah effectively ceased to exist as a nation. But as this tragedy was unfolding, the fall of Jerusalem, there was a prophet named Jeremiah who predicted that as great an empire as Babylon was, it would not be around for long. In fact, he predicted that the Babylonian captivity of the Israelites, I suppose dating it from 606 when Nebuchadnezzar first came, would not last over 70 years. And sure enough, on October the 12th, 539 BC, Cyrus overthrew the Babylonians and the Medo-Persian Empire came into existence. Cyrus was a comparatively enlightened emperor who allowed many captives of many different peoples to return to their homelands. In fact, he allowed Jewish people to return to their homeland. About 43,000 of them chose to do that. They returned with a man named Zerubbabel as their leader, and they rebuilt the Solomonic Temple. Although it was such a sorry excuse for the Solomonic Temple that the old people who remembered Solomon's Temple before Nebuchadnezzar destroyed it cried. It was a temple. It was a place to worship, but it had nothing of the splendor of Solomon's temple. But Ezra returned to the land, and he reinstituted the Passover feast, and the people, with their temple and with their Passover, began to be a nation of sorts once again. However, most of the Jewish people who were taken into captivity, and there were hundreds of thousands of them, to Babylon, chose not to return to Jerusalem when Cyrus allowed them to. They were reasonably comfortable in Babylon. And once the Persians took over, they were even more comfortable because the Persians tended to be nicer people. They ceased to think of themselves as exiles. After all, hadn't Jeremiah told them to settle down in the city and seek the peace of the city, the success of the city where they lived? I want you to turn with me to a great chapter that is often ignored in terms of its context, the 29th chapter of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 29, because this is a most important concept for us to grasp this morning. This chapter contains a letter that Jeremiah wrote to the exiles in Babylon who stayed there, the exiles in Persia, instead of going back to the Holy Land. So this is a letter by Jeremiah to the exiles. He says, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, see, what verse are we in here? Verse 4. This is what the God of Israel says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses, settle down, plant gardens, and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. That's Babylon. Pray to the Lord for Babylon, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Well, the Jews took Jeremiah seriously. They took him too seriously. They forgot what Jeremiah wrote next in his letter. Look at verse 10. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my gracious promise to bring you back to Jerusalem. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I will bring you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile. Yes, Jeremiah told them to settle down in Babylon and the cities where they were taken in exile. Pray for the city. Prosper there. But not permanently. In 70 years, he said, I will come to you and I want you to come back to the land and reestablish yourself there. But many of these Jews remained in Babylon. Jews are very successful merchants. They had established small businesses. They had become wealthy. Some had even advanced in the government. They reasoned, why give up all this wealth and comfort to go back to that wasteland that was once called the Promised Land? Now, I'd like to suggest to you today that there is a parallel between the Jews in exile in Persia and the people of God today, particularly here in the United States. We are spiritual exiles. We are aliens. We are strangers, or at least we're supposed to be. But too many of us have forgotten that we are exiles. Listen to what Peter says in 1 Peter 1:17. He says, live your lives as strangers here. And later on he says, dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. But we've become pretty comfortable in our exile. And we have become successful. We have taken Jeremiah's advice to pray for our city and our nation, because when they are successful, we are successful. But in the process, we have perhaps forgotten that our sojourn in the empire is supposed to be temporary, and that we have a higher calling. I asked the question, how are we to live as exiles? And I'd like to respond to that with three suggestions. First, we must not take the power and glory of this world too seriously. Sometimes we just have to laugh at its presumption. We have laughed, I trust you have laughed internally, at the power brokers in the Persian Empire, at their pomposity and their presumption and their self-importance. I think likewise we have to laugh at our own empire today. In fact, if we didn't laugh, we would be crying all the time. Some of us take government too seriously, I think. We get very angry at the government, or we become very fearful. We begin to believe that the domino theory is an absolute law of the universe, and that if one more tax is raised, or one more textbook treats evolution as an absolute fact, or if one more state adopts gay marriage, that's all she wrote. The end is near. Maybe. Maybe not. I remember the late 60s. I was in seminary then, and the world seemed to be going to hell in a handbasket. Woodstock happened, and it did not seem like the peaceful rock concert that historians have made it out to be. It seemed like the culture was absolutely imploding. The Black Panthers and the Weathermen made us feel that anarchy and revolution were right around the corner. There were tanks on the streets of Kansas City after the death of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. I remember almost despairing and saying to myself, what am I doing studying Greek and Hebrew in seminary while the world is going nuts? Some of you who are younger perhaps felt the same way during the Carter economic collapse, or during the Clinton moral collapse, or during the collapse of the Twin Towers in as recently as 2001. Maybe you even feel that way today as you see freedoms eroding and oil exploding and an emperor without clothes surrounded by advisors who seem more like stooges than wise men. I encourage you, friends, to laugh a little. And not just at government, but at the corporate world, and the educational world, and the sports world, and even the ecclesiastical world, all of whom take themselves much too seriously, much of the time. I don't mean that we shouldn't be concerned about our culture or our society. I don't mean that you shouldn't be politically active. And I certainly don't mean that you shouldn't pray. But don't despair. Don't lose heart. Don't lose your sense of humor. God is still in control. You remember Psalm 2? Look at this. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against His anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then He rebukes them in His anger and terrifies them in His wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. If God can laugh at them, why can't we laugh at them? a little bit. Why is it we can laugh? Because their power is so piddly and so temporary, friends. A few verses were read from Isaiah chapter 40 this morning. I want to read a few others which tell us what God thinks of the power and pomposity of emperors and presidents and prime ministers throughout history. Here's his evaluation. Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. That's what God thinks of the United Nations. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Let me just stop there a minute. Lebanon was known for the great cedars of Lebanon, trees unrivaled anywhere else in the world. He said, if you took the nation of Lebanon and made it an altar, and you cut down every tree and piled it up on that altar, and you slew every beast in those forests, it still wouldn't be enough to honor our God. Before Him, all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by Him as worthless and less than nothing. Secondly, we need to discern the fingerprints of God even when He is silent. I've already noted for you that God is not mentioned in this book, but He is not absent from this book. Just because we cannot see God working does not mean He is not working. Even in this chapter, God is clearly behind the scenes, creating a vacancy in the royal palace that He's going to fill with a person of His choice. God's name is less and less welcome in public life in our empire, but He's still there. We must discern the times, and we must look for His fingerprints. We must honor God as the Lord of our lives. And thirdly, we need to realize how different our king is from Xerxes, and his kingdom is from the empire. Just think about some of the differences. The God we serve is not capricious. He's not self-centered. He's not a show-off. He doesn't treat people as objects to feed His pride and His pleasure. His law is beneficial to men and women alike. He too has planned a sumptuous banquet for His people. But when God summons His bride to that banquet, it will not be to expose her to shame, but to lavish His grace and mercy upon her. One cannot help but cheer Vashti for refusing to come before this drunk emperor. But friends, there is nothing noble about people today refusing to come to the banquet our good and gracious God has planned. And if you refuse to come to His banquet, you will be banished from His presence forever. Remember, the empire is not our home. And when Jesus returns, the true banquet will begin. Would you bow with me in prayer?